This brings us straight to the question, does AA have a real leadership? The answer is yes, notwithstanding the apparent lack of it. Let's turn again to the deposed founder and his friends. What becomes of them? As their grief and anxiety wear away, a subtle change begins. Ultimately, they divide into two classes known in AA slang as elder statesmen and bleeding deacons. The elder statesman is one who sees the wisdom of the group's decision, who holds no resentment over his reduced status, whose judgment, fortified by considerable experience, is sound, and who is willing to sit quietly on the sidelines, patiently awaiting developments. The bleeding deacon is one who remains convinced that the group cannot get along without him, who constantly connives for re-election to office, and who continues to be consumed with self-pity. A few deacons hemorrhage so badly that they become drained of all AA spirit and principles and get drunk. At times, the AA landscape seems to be littered with bleeding forms. Nearly every old-timer in our society has gone through this process in some degree. I have myself. Happily, most of them survive and live to become elder statesmen. This is the real and enduring leadership of AA. Theirs is the quiet opinion, the sure knowledge, and the humble example that resolves a crisis. When sorely perplexed, the group inevitably turns to them for advice. They become the voice of the group conscience. They are, in fact, the true voice of Alcoholics Anonymous. They do not drive by mandate. They lead by example. This is how Tradition 9 was evolved. This is why AA can never be organized under any known form of government. But it also remains abundantly clear that we can and must create service boards or committees to be directly responsible to those they serve. Tomorrow afternoon, in this auditorium, the same drama of AA leadership will be reenacted for AA as a whole. The group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous, as represented by your named and chosen General Service Conference, will take over the permanent care and custody of the organized world service of this entire fellowship. And in the spirit of Tradition 9, we old-timers will step aside, leaving with you only the offer of our advice, if and when you want it. We shall no longer direct or govern, nor will anybody else. AA, as such, should always remain unorganized. It will fall then to your lot to guard this treasured principle. We think the future safety of Alcoholics Anonymous greatly depends upon Tradition 10, AA's principle of no controversy at the public level. This tradition reads as follows. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Since it began, Alcoholics Anonymous never has been divided by a major controversial issue. Our fellowship never has taken sides publicly on any question in this embattled world. This has been no earned virtue. It could almost be said that we were born with it. For as one old-timer recently declared, practically never have I heard a heated religious, political, or reform argument among AA members. So long as we don't argue these matters privately, it's a cinch we never shall argue them publicly. As by some deep instinct, we have known from the very beginning that no matter what the provocation, we must never publicly take sides, as AAs, in any fight, even a worthy one. All history affords us the spectacle of striving nations and groups finally torn asunder because they were designed for or tempted into controversy. Others fell apart because of sheer self-righteousness while trying to force upon the rest of mankind some millennium of their own specification. In our own times, we have seen millions die in political and economic wars, often spurred by religious and racial differences. We live in the imminent possibility of a fresh Holocaust to determine how men shall be governed and how the products of nature and toil shall be divided among them. That is the spiritual climate in which AA was born and by God's grace has flourished nevertheless. Let us reemphasize that this reluctance to fight one another or anybody else is not counted as some special virtue which makes us feel superior to other people. Nor does it mean that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, now restored as citizens of the world, are going to back away from their individual responsibilities to act as they see the right upon issues of our time. But when it comes to AA as a whole, that is a different matter. As AAs, we do not enter into public controversy, because we know that our fellowship will perish if we do. We conceive the survival and spread of Alcoholics Anonymous to be something of greater importance than any weight we could collectively throw back of other causes. Recovery from alcoholism is life itself to us, and we wish to preserve in full strength our means of survival. Maybe this sounds as though the alcoholics in AA had suddenly gone peaceable and had become one great big happy family. Of course, this is not so at all. We are human beings, and we squabble. Before we leveled off a bit, AA looked more like one prodigious squabble than anything else, at least on the surface. A corporation director who had just voted a company expenditure of $100,000 would appear at an AA business meeting and blow his top over an outlay of $25 worth of needed postage stamps. Disliking the attempt of some to manage the group, half of its membership might angrily rush off to form another group more to their liking. Elders, temporarily turned Pharisee, often sulked. Sometimes bitter attacks have been directed against people suspected of mixed motives. Yet, despite their din, our rows have never done AA a particle of harm. They were just part and parcel of learning to work and live together. Let it be noted, too, that they were almost always concerned with how to make AA more effective, how to do the most good for the most alcoholics. The Washingtonian Society, a movement among alcoholics which started in Baltimore a century ago, almost discovered the answer to alcoholism. At first, the society was composed entirely of alcoholics trying to help one another. The early members foresaw that they should dedicate themselves to this sole aim. In many respects, the Washingtonians were akin to AA. Their membership passed the 500,000 mark. Had they stuck to their one goal, they might have found the full answer. Instead, the Washingtonians permitted politicians and reformers, both alcoholic and non-alcoholic, to use the society for their own purposes. Abolition of slavery, for example, was a stormy political issue then. Soon, Washingtonian speakers violently and publicly took sides on this question. Maybe the society could have survived the abolition controversy, but it did not have a chance from the moment it determined to reform all America's drinking habits. Some of the Washingtonians became temperance crusaders. Within a very few years, they had completely lost their effectiveness in helping alcoholics, and the society collapsed. The lesson to be learned from the Washingtonians was not overlooked by Alcoholics Anonymous. As we surveyed the wreck of that movement, early AA members resolved to keep our society out of public controversy. Considering how most of us have really loved controversy, this denial of the privilege of attacking something or somebody in public is no small achievement for the naturally aggressive people that we are. To make our survival as a fellowship sure, we have often gone far in the opposite direction. Years ago, for example, we stood in great fear of the misuse of the AA name by AAs and outside groups who wanted to use it for their own money-raising, controversial, or publicity purposes. And we reflected that the bigger AA grew, the greater this temptation would surely be. Therefore, we felt we had to find a way legally to protect the precious name of our society. Our trustees were advised that this could be done only by incorporating the name Alcoholics Anonymous in every state of the Union and in all foreign countries. We actually began this tedious, complicated, and expensive task, which finally bogged down in a mass of technicalities, red tape, and charters. But the issue was revived with a bang when one of the large motion picture producers suddenly came up with a script for a picture which they were going to call Mr. and Miss Anonymous. The proposed portrayal of A.A. seemed pretty lopsided and in rather bad taste. Though they agreed to change the title, the company refused to do much of anything about the objectionable script. What, then, could we do about it? We concluded that we ought to ask for an injunction against the company for misuse of the AA name. This prospect of legal action caused the company to revise the script more to our liking. Otherwise, we might have sued, forgetting all about AA's principle of non-controversy in public. We were that excited. After this moving picture incident, our chairman, Bernard Smith, came up with what looked like a wonderful idea. As a lawyer, he thought Alcoholics Anonymous could easily obtain a congressional charter, an act of Congress which would protect the AA name everywhere. This would put us in the same class as the Red Cross and several other notable organizations. It was thought that the mere existence of such a charter would restrain nearly all those who might be tempted to misuse AA's name, and a legal bludgeon of this size and weight could easily be used on any who might still defy the law. It looked like a grand idea, and we at the headquarters were all for it. But the conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous, its General Service Conference, had other ideas. The conference pointed out to us how foolish it would be to incorporate AA's way of life as a legal instrument with which to attack anyone, no matter what the provocation. We would not be content with such an instrument for purposes of pure restraint. Under enough provocation, we would be bound to start public lawsuits and thus enter the field of public controversy. It would be like building a war machine on the theory that it would always stay home and never fight. It would mean the legal organization of a fellowship whose traditions insisted on its being unorganized. The conference thought we ought to forget about the questionable advantages of legality and controversy and rely upon group and public opinion for our ultimate protection. After long debate, we at the headquarters saw that the conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous, acting through the delegates, was wiser than we were. So the Congress of the United States was never asked to incorporate AA. The moving resolution by which the conference took this action ought to be set on the record. It was drawn by Delegate Bob T., a Mississippi lawyer. Reporting for his committee, he said, "We have reviewed all of the arguments pro and con on this subject, have discussed it with many members of AA within the conference and outside of it, and we have come to these conclusions. 1. The evils which caused the question to arise have largely abated. 2. A congressional incorporation would create by law a power to govern which would be contrary to and violative of our traditions. 3. It would implement the spiritual force of AA with a legal power, which we believe would tend to weaken its spiritual strength. 4. When we ask for legal rights, enforceable in courts of law, we, by the same act, subject ourselves to possible legal regulation. 5. We might well become endlessly entangled in litigation, which, together with the incidental expense and publicity, could seriously threaten our very existence. 6. Incorporation of AA could conceivably become the opening wedge that might engender politics and a struggle for power within our own ranks. 7. Continuously since its beginning and today, AA has been a fellowship and not an organization. Incorporation necessarily makes it an organization. 8. We believe that spiritual faith and a way of life cannot be incorporated. 9. AA can and will survive so long as it remains a spiritual faith and a way of life open to all men and women who suffer from alcoholism. Therefore, keeping in mind the high purpose of the General Service Conference, as expressed by the chairman last year when he said, "We seek not compromise but certainty," your committee unanimously recommends that Alcoholics Anonymous does not incorporate. Thus, the final foundation was laid for Tradition 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Tradition 11 grew out of a large and strenuous public relations experience. Today, it reads as follows. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Without its legions of well-wishers, AA could never have grown as it has. Throughout the world, favorable publicity has been the principal means of bringing alcoholics into our fellowship. In AA offices, clubs, and homes, telephones ring constantly. One boy says, "I read a piece in the newspaper." Another, "We heard a radio program." And still another, "We saw a moving picture." Or, "We saw something about AA on television." It is no exaggeration to say that half of AA's membership has been led to us through channels like these. The inquiring voices are not all alcoholics or their families. Doctors read medical papers about AA and call for more information. Clergymen see articles in their church journals and also make inquiries. Employers learn that great corporations have set their approval upon us and wish to discover what can be done about alcoholism in their own firms. Therefore, the responsibility fell upon us to develop the best possible public relations policy for Alcoholics Anonymous. Through many painful experiences, we think we have arrived at what that policy ought to be. It is opposite in many ways to the usual promotional practice. We found that we had to rely upon the principle of attraction rather than promotion. Let's see how these two contrasting ideas, attraction and promotion, work out. A political party wishes to win an election, and so it advertises the virtue of its leadership in order to draw votes. A worthy charity wants to raise money, and so its letterhead shows the names of every distinguished person whose support can be obtained. Much of the political, economic, and religious life of the world is dependent upon publicized leadership. People who symbolize causes and ideas fill a deep human need. We of AA do not question that, but we do have to face the fact that being in the public eye is hazardous, especially for us. By temperament, many of us had been irresponsible promoters, and the prospect of a society composed largely of promoters was frightening. We knew we had to exercise self-restraint. The way this restraint paid off is interesting. It has resulted in more favorable publicity for Alcoholics Anonymous than could possibly have been obtained through all the arts and abilities of AA's best press agents. Obviously, AA had to be publicized somehow. So we resorted to the idea that it would be far better to let our friends do this for us. And they have done it to an amazing extent. Veteran newsmen, trained doubters that they are, have gone all out to carry AA's message. To them, we are something more than the source of good stories. On almost every news front, men and women of the press have become our friends. In the beginning, they could not understand our refusal of all personal publicity. They were genuinely baffled by our insistence upon anonymity. But soon they got the point. Here was something rare in the world, a society which said it wished to publicize its principles and its work, but not its individual members. The press was pleased with this attitude, and these friends ever since have reported AA with an enthusiasm which the most ardent members themselves could hardly match. There was actually a time when the press of America thought the anonymity of AA was better for us than some of our own members did. At one point, about 100 of our society were breaking anonymity at the public level. With perfectly good intent, these folks declared that the principle of anonymity was horse and buggy stuff, something appropriate to AA's pioneering days. They were sure that AA could go faster and farther if it availed itself of modern publicity methods. AA, they pointed out, included many persons of local, national, or international fame. Provided they were willing, and many were, why shouldn't their membership be publicized, thereby encouraging others to join us. There were plausible arguments, but happily our friends of the writing profession disagreed with them. Years earlier, our headquarters had written letters to practically every news outlet in North America, setting forth our public relations policy of attraction rather than promotion, and emphasizing personal anonymity as AA's greatest protection. Since that time, editors and rewrite men have repeatedly deleted names and pictures of members from AA copy. Frequently, they have reminded ambitious individuals of AA's anonymity policy. They have even sacrificed good stories to this end. The force of their cooperation has helped beyond measure. Only a very few AA members are left who deliberately break anonymity at the public level. An old story revealing several aspects of AA's public relations problem comes to mind. One of our pioneer members conceived the idea of starting a group in his city by radio. The local station, with a radius of about 100 miles, offered to help. So our promoter friend constructed a series of 12 lectures on Alcoholics Anonymous. These were a strange mixture of AA and his own religious ideas. He soon put them on the air with all the vigor of a Chautauqua orator. Contrary to our expectations, he got a modest result. Inquiries came in, and he started a group. Now, flushed with success, he was smitten with a wonderful vision. He wrote headquarters, telling how a prominent life insurance company would sponsor him on a national network to deliver his 12 lectures. He was going to appear under his own name as an AA member. For doing such a great work, of course, he was to receive a generous fee. We remonstrated, but it was no use. We advised him that the trustees felt his message inappropriate for national consumption. So he wrote a hot letter to this effect. To hell with the trustees. The world is waiting for my message. I've got the right of free speech, and I'm going on the air whether you like it or not. This ultimatum was an alarming poser. It looked like promotion, professionalism, and anonymity breaking all in one package. If this sort of venture proved successful, from the promoter's point of view, every ad man and salesman in Alcoholics Anonymous would soon be selling AA's wares willy-nilly. We would lose all control of our public relations. So, headquarters took this tack. We assured our well-meaning friend that we would certainly uphold his right of free speech. But we added that he ought to uphold ours, too. We assured him that if his lectures went on the air, we would advise every AA group of the circumstances and ask them to write strong letters to the sponsoring life insurance company, letters of a kind the sponsor might not like to receive. The broadcast never went on the air. As a result of this incident, AA's trustees were empowered to conduct our overall public relations, and the principle of attraction rather than promotion became established as the key to our relation with the world about us. It is no accident that the original long-form draft of Tradition 11 carries the statement that it is better to let our friends recommend us. This, in brief, is the process by which AA's Tradition 11 was developed. To us, it represents more than a sound public relations policy. It is more than a denial of self-seeking. Tradition 11 is certainly a constant reminder that personal ambition has no place in AA, but it also implies that each member ought to become an active guardian of our fellowship in its relation with the general public. As we have seen, anonymity is the protective mantle that covers our whole society. But it is more than protection. It has another dimension, a spiritual significance. And this leads to Tradition 12, which reads, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. In my belief, the entire future of our fellowship hangs upon this vital principle. If we continue to be filled with the spirit and practice of anonymity, no shoal or reef can wreck us. If we forget this principle, the lid to Pandora's box will be off, and the spirits of money, power, and prestige will be loosed among us. Obsessed by these evil genii, we might well flounder and bake up. I devoutly believe this will never happen. No AA principle merits more study and application than this one. I am positive that AA's anonymity is the key to long-time survival. The spiritual substance of anonymity is sacrifice. Because AA's 12 traditions repeatedly ask us to give up personal desires for the common good, we realize that the sacrificial spirit, well symbolized by anonymity, is the foundation of all these traditions. It is AA's proved willingness to make these sacrifices that gives people high confidence in our future. But in the beginning, anonymity was not born of confidence. It was the child of our early fears. Our first nameless groups of alcoholics were secret societies. New prospects could find us only through a few trusted friends. The bare hint of publicity, even when it was not for ourselves but for our work, shocked us. Although we were no longer drinking, we still thought we had to hide from public distrust and contempt. When the Big Book appeared in 1939, we called it Alcoholics Anonymous. Its original foreword made this revealing statement: "It is important that we remain anonymous because we are too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication. Being mostly business or professional folks, we could not well carry on our occupations in such an event." Between these lines, it is easy to read our fear that large numbers of incoming people might break our anonymity wide open. As the AA groups multiplied, so did anonymity problems. Excited over the spectacular recovery of a brother alcoholic, we would sometimes discuss intimate and harrowing aspects of his case that had been meant for his sponsor's ear alone. The aggrieved victim would then rightly declare that his trust had been broken. When reports of such cases got into circulation outside of AA, the resulting loss of confidence in our anonymity promise was severe. It sometimes turned people from us. Clearly, each AA member's name, and his story too, had to be kept confidential if he wished it to be. This was our first lesson in the practical application of anonymity. On the other hand, however, with characteristically alcoholic intemperance, some of our newcomers cared not at all for personal anonymity. They wanted to shout about AA from the housetops, and did. Alcoholics barely dry in AA rushed about bright-eyed, buttonholing anyone who would listen to their stories. Others hurried to place themselves before microphones and cameras. Sometimes they got drunk and let their groups down with a bang. They had changed from AA members into AA show-offs. This phenomenon of contrast on the anonymity issue really set us thinking. Squarely before us was the question, how anonymous should an AA member be? Our growth made it plain that we could not be a secret society, but it was equally plain that we could not be a vaudeville circuit either. The charting of a safe path between these extremes took a long time. As a rule, the average newcomer wanted his family to know immediately what he was trying to do. He also wanted to tell others who had tried to help him, his doctor, his minister, and close friends. As he gained confidence, he felt it right to explain his new way of life to his employer and business associates. When opportunities to be helpful came along, he found he could talk easily about AA to almost anyone. These quiet disclosures helped him to lose his fear of the alcoholic stigma and to spread the news of AA's existence in his community. Many a new man and woman came to AA as a result of such conversations. Though not within the strict letter of anonymity, these communications were well within its spirit. But it became apparent that the word-of-mouth method of letting people know about AA was limited. Our work, as such, needed to be publicized. AA groups wanted quickly to reach as many despairing alcoholics as they could. Consequently, Many groups began to hold meetings which were open to interested friends and to the public, so that the average citizen could see for himself just what AA was all about. The response to these meetings was warmly sympathetic. Soon, groups began to receive requests for AA speakers to appear before civic organizations, church groups, and medical societies. Provided reporters present were cautioned against the use of full names or pictures, the result was fine. Then came our first few excursions into major publicity, and these were breathtaking. Cleveland's Plain Dealer articles about us ran that town's membership from a few dozen into hundreds overnight. The news stories of Mr. Rockefeller's dinner for Alcoholics Anonymous helped double our total membership in a year's time. Jack Alexander's famous Saturday Evening Post piece made AA a national institution. Such tributes as these brought opportunities for still more recognition. Other newspapers and magazines wanted AA stories. Film companies wanted to photograph us. Radio and finally television companies besieged us with requests for cooperation. What should we do? As this title offering of top public approval swept in, we realized that it could do us incalculable good or great harm. Everything would depend on how it was channeled. We simply could not afford to take the chance of letting self-appointed members present themselves as messiahs representing AA before the whole public. The promoter instinct in us might be our undoing. If even one such person publicly got drunk or was lured into using AA's name for his own purposes, the damage might be irreparable. At this altitude, press, radio, films, and television, anonymity, 100% anonymity, was the only possible answer. Here, principles would have to come before personalities without exception. These experiences taught us that anonymity is real humility at work. It is an all-pervading spiritual quality which today keynotes AA life everywhere. Moved by the spirit of anonymity, we try to give up our natural desires for personal distinction as AA members, both among fellow alcoholics and before the general public. As we lay aside these very human aspirations, we believe that each of us takes part in the weaving of a protective mantle which covers our whole society and under which we may grow and work in unity. We are sure that humility, expressed by anonymity, is the greatest safeguard that Alcoholics Anonymous can ever have. In recent years, our awareness of the deep significance of anonymity has grown in a most heartening and wonderful way. At one time, many numbers of AAs were breaking anonymity, and I was one of them. Today, these numbers are reduced to a mere handful. Despite our alcoholic yearnings for vainglory, this is a tremendous guarantee of even finer things to come. The kind of sacrifice that we shall always need to make is beautifully illustrated by a talk I recently had with a certain Texas lady. Her temptation was extreme, because she is in show business and has great national popularity as an entertainer. This is what she told me. "I sing in the best bar rooms only, and I've been doing it for 15 years. Within a year after joining AA, I lost about 10 pounds, the bags came out from under my eyes, and I began to look like a human being. My manager couldn't figure it out, but at last I told him what had happened to me. At once he said, 'But aren't you and I going to tell the public about this? Why, this would make terrific publicity, both for AA and you too.' Well, I said, 'Temporarily, I know that it would. Other people have proved that, but please, not for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has a principle called anonymity. No public big shots allowed. We know that AA can't be run like show business, no matter what the short-term benefits may be. AA saved my life and my career. Therefore, the future welfare of Alcoholics Anonymous is more important to me than any publicity that I could get as an AA member.' Then, a little wistfully, she added, 'You know, Bill, I often see drunks in my audience and wonder how I can help them. If only I could tell them from the stage that I am in AA. But that would only be temporary, wouldn't it? In the long run, we'd all be ruined if everybody did it. I looked at the lady from Texas and was glad, very glad. Because I myself have always had strong tendencies toward the pursuit of prestige, wealth, and power, all of AA's traditions have borne down upon me with great force. You will remember that episode back in our living room on Clinton Street. That was the time when my group told me I could never become an AA professional. With nearly every tradition, much the same thing has happened. At first, I obeyed because I had to. I would have lost my standing in AA if I had not. After a while, I began to obey because I saw that the traditions were wise and right. While I conformed because it was right to do so, I still resisted inwardly. This was particularly true of anonymity. Today, I hope I have come to a time in my AA life when I can obey because I really want to obey, because I really want the traditions for myself as well as for AA as a whole. Therefore, each of our 12 traditions is really an expression of the deflation that each of us has to take, of the sacrifice that we shall all have to make in order to live and work together. Dr. Bob was essentially a far more humble person than I. In some ways, he was a sort of spiritual natural, and this anonymity business came rather easily to him. He could not understand why some people should want so much publicity. In the years before he died, his personal example, respecting anonymity, did much to help me keep my own lid on. I think of one affecting instance in particular, one that every AA ought to know. When it was sure that Dr. Bob was mortally afflicted, some of his friends suggested that there should be a suitable monument or mausoleum erected in honor of him and his wife Anne, something befitting a founder and his lady. Of course, this was a very natural and moving tribute. The committee went so far as to show him a sketch of the proposed edifice. Telling me about this, Dr. Bob grinned broadly and said, "God bless them, they mean well, but for heaven's sakes, Bill, let you and I get buried just like other folks." A year after his passing, I visited the Akron Cemetery where Dr. Bob and Anne lie. The simple stone says not a word about Alcoholics Anonymous. Some people may think that this wonderful couple carried personal anonymity too far when they so firmly refused to use the words Alcoholics Anonymous even on their own burial stone. For one, I do not think so. I think that this moving and final example of self-effacement will prove of more permanent worth to AA than any amount of public attention or any great monument. The AA Principles of Service, as expressed in the 12 Traditions and the 12 Steps. Each AA group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Here is a note. The traditional principles of AA service stated above have been amplified by Bill W. and made a part of the AA Service Manual and 12 Concepts for World Service. Service, the Third Legacy. We are gathered here for the final hours of AA's 20th anniversary celebration. Above us floats a banner on which is inscribed the new symbol for AA, a circle enclosing a triangle. The circle stands for the whole world of AA, and the triangle stands for AA's three legacies of recovery, unity, and service. Within our wonderful new world, we have found freedom from our fatal obsession. that we have chosen this particular symbol is perhaps no accident. The priests and seers of antiquity regarded the circle enclosing the triangle as a means of warding off spirits of evil, and AA's circle and triangle of recovery, unity, and service has certainly meant all of that to us and much more. On our first evening together here in St. Louis, we looked at the base of our triangle, AA's first legacy of recovery, on which everything rests and depends. During our second evening, we contemplated unity, AA's second legacy, and all its vast meaning for our future. Now, we want to think about the third side of our triangle, AA's third legacy of service, which in this afternoon's closing hour will be delivered into your hands for all time to come. Then, our symbol will be complete, and may recovery, unity, and service, the means by which under God our fellowship has been created, be ever at His command for so long as He may use this society. AA's 12th step, carrying the message, is the basic service that our fellowship gives. It is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of recovered alcoholics in action. We must carry AA's message. Otherwise, we ourselves may fall into decay, and those who have not yet been given the truth may die. This is why we so often say that action is the magic word. Action to carry AA's message is therefore the heart of our third legacy of service. Yet some of us are still a bit confused about AA's third legacy. We still ask, just what is this third legacy business anyhow? And just how much territory does service action take in? The answer is simple. An AA service is anything whatever that legitimately helps us to reach fellow sufferers. As we have seen, the 12-step call is the greatest of AA services, but the publicity that caused the prospect to get in touch with us, the car we rode in, the gasoline we paid for, and the cups of coffee we bought him, all of these aids were necessary to make our call possible and effective. And this is only the start. Our services involve meeting places, hospital cooperation, intergroup offices, and pamphlets and books. Services can require committees, delegates, trustees, and conferences. They include small voluntary money contributions so that the group, the area, and AA as a whole can function. They range all the way from a cup of coffee up to AA's General Service Headquarters for national and international action. The sum of all these services is AA's third legacy. Such services are utterly necessary to AA's existence and growth. Yearning for simplicity, we often wonder if we could not do away with many of AA's present services. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have no bother, no politics, no expense, and no responsibility? But this is only a dream about simplicity. It would not be simplicity in fact. Without its essential services, AA would soon become a formless, confused, and irresponsible anarchy. Regarding any particular service, we need to ask only one question. Is this or that service really needed? If it is not, then let it be eliminated. But if it is needed, then maintain it we must, or fail in our mission to those who want and seek AA. For 20 years now, we AAs have been trying to determine what are needed services and what are not. As I tell the story of the growth of AA services, I hope that the vision of our third legacy will come clear.